Hello!
Hey guys, it's Arden Cho.
Hey, I'm Holland Roden.
Hello, this is Ian Bowen.
Hey you guys, this is Melissa Poncio.
Hi, I'm Lyndon Ashby.
Hi, I'm Dylan Sprayberry.
This is Megan Tandy.
This is Tyler Posey, and you are listening to Not Another.
Not Another.
Not Another.
This is Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast.
Yes, it is!
Oh.
Woo!
Hey, this is Jeff Davis. You're listening to Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast, my favorite podcast in the world.
As a warning sign that if you talk enough sense, then you'll lose your mind. And I'll use you as a focal point, so I don't lose sight of what I want. And I move further than I thought I could. But I missed you more than I thought I would. And I'll use you as a warning sign that if you talk enough sense, then you'll lose your mind.
Hi everyone, welcome to Not Another Teen Wolf podcast for the week. We are recording our episode 105, recapping season 5, episode 8, Ouroboros, which we've practiced saying quite a few times. Karen and I are joined this week by a special guest who I'll introduce in a moment, but we are here, your lead hosts, Karen and myself. I'm Natalie, if you're tuning in for the first time. If you want to get in touch with us after the show with any opinions on what we've had to say or any thoughts about what's coming up with Teen Wolf, you can reach us on our Twitter, which is NATW Podcast. You can reach us on our email, which is natwpodcast@gmail.com. You can join us on Tumblr, which is notanotherteenwolfpodcast.tumblr.com. You can go on our Instagram, which is NATW Podcast, or you can comment on this post on hyperball.com, our parent site, and leave a comment on the podcast page there. So, as I said, we've got myself with you today. We've got Karen. So, hello, Karen.
Hi.
Hi, Karen. And we also have a guest from Teen Wolf, Will Wallace, who's been on the podcast before. Hi, Will.
Hey, how are y'all today?
Good, good. So the reason that we're having Will on this week is because you may or may not have noticed that he is credited as the lead writer for this episode. And Will has been on the podcast before. He came on to talk about his role at Teen Wolf as a writer's assistant, which was a lot of fun, very interesting, and a lot of people really like that podcast. But it just goes to, you know, show that, you know, sometimes, you know, hard work and ambition, etc., pays off, because he got to headline the writing for this episode, which we're going to talk a little bit more about how that worked for him later in the show. He's sitting with us through the whole recap, though, because as we were kind of talking about before I started the podcast, usually when we do an interview, we don't have the person on for our standard recap, because it can be a bit awkward if we're talking, you know, if we're asking each other questions that, you know, to the person would be really boring or really stupid, like, you know, our own theories, or if we're saying something critical or that we didn't understand it, you know, it's a bit awkward to have the interview subject there during that. However, Will, apart from being a staff writer, an assistant on Teen Wolf, also listens to our podcast quite a lot, and he was going to listen to this episode regardless of whether we had him on or not. So anything that we had to say about the episode that he wrote, he was going to hear it regardless. So he's going to just sit here and talk through us with the whole episode, which is really, really fun, and hopefully should be a good time for everyone. So thank you very much for joining us, and for, basically sitting through this with us. So hopefully this was a good week for you to get to show off to, I guess, all your family, friends, etc., the episode that you wrote.
Oh no, it's been wonderful. It's been a great time so far, and Monday was a great day. I got a lot of texts and messages on Facebook and stuff like that from family and friends. And you're absolutely right. I would be listening to this podcast anyway, so I am happy to be here for the whole thing.
Yeah, we knew he was going to be like, what if Karen and Natalie had to say about my episode, regardless of whether he was here or not. So he's here, and he's going to give us some insight. First of all, we're going to go through our, you know, our favorite quotes of the episode, as we do every week, and Will is included in that this week. So my favorite was when Sheriff confronted the Yukimuras about their claim, you know, with Kira's dad being the quote-unquote murderer. And he says, this is what you're going to go with. This is your story. And Mrs. Yukimura says, are you prepared to tell a different one? Because I just love everything about what they did, like her parents in this episode, and how they just, both them and Melissa are sort of very done with, you know, this, you know, strange handling of the supernatural things in the law, because that's a big factor of this episode that we'll talk about, like about what side of that is kind of the best way to handle it. But Karen, yours was kind of also in relation to that concept.
Yeah, this is sort of when Melissa confronts the sheriff and she's getting really sassy with him, which was amazing. And he wants her statement, but she gives him the real statement. And he's like, are you kidding? And she's like, you're right. I forgot about the Dread Doctors. And she takes it back to keep writing. It was amazing.
Yeah. How about you, Will? What was your favorite quote, I guess? And did you have a hand in creating it? Was it your own words, or was it something that the writing team came up with together?
Well, as far as Karen's quote, that whole scene between Stilinski and Melissa was a lot of fun, because it was really just figuring out exactly how sassy Melissa was going to be to him, you know, and of course it's in the worst possible time, you know, but she's like, okay, if we're doing this, we're doing this, and I'm going to write down everything that's happened because this is what you want to do. And it was just a lot of fun just trying to figure out how sassy she was going to be to him. And then Melissa playing it, those dailies were just so much fun to watch. And then it's wonderful in the episode because they're just so wonderful together. And Melissa's just the best. But my quote is from the end of the episode when Scott is alone in his room and he's holding the leash from his dog. And Melissa comes in and he says, something's changed and I think it's because of me. And that's my favorite quote for the episode, just because this whole season is about sort of tearing Scott down, and we're really starting to see him in places that he's never been before. And just as a writer, that's, you always want to do that with your characters, you know, is really push them to their limits. And that is what we are doing to Scott this season.
And as an audience member, it is very painful. Just saying.
Wonderful.
We've grouped the discussion about this episode into sort of segments of different plot aspects rather than like scene by scene by scene, because it did jump around a lot. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was the opening scene of Deaton and then his final scene as well, which is he's somewhere Russian, apparently, at some sort of place that is meant to be a nuclear plant but isn't, where they find experimentation that has been done. The Dread Doctors have been there before. He's off searching for information about the Dread Doctors. And he kind of has a local guide who's heard the stories about what's happened before, and he tells Deaton that the symbol for the Dread Doctors is the Ouroboros, the snake eating its own tail. And that's our first big question, because the Ouroboros is something that I've come across before just in life and, you know, mythology. But it's not historically like an evil thing. It's not like a swastika. You know, it's not like, you know, a symbol of a skull and crossbones. It's not actually a bad guy mark necessarily, but, you know, so it kind of represents like an eternal cycle, like a phoenix in most mythology, like a end and a beginning, and, you know, like a circular life cycle, or, you know, circular universe. So, but it does appear in a lot of different legends. So I guess the first question for Will specifically is, what can you tell us about kind of what that symbol means to you and why it was chosen for the Dread Doctors, if that's not a spoilery thing?
No, it's not spoilery at all. When we were looking for, you know, because all, you know, good villains need a symbol, like all of our packs have a symbol and stuff like that. We were thinking of, like, you know, well, what is the symbol of the Dread Doctors? And Jeff actually came upon the Ouroboros, if I'm remembering correctly. And you're right, it's not an evil symbol. It's something, you know, it's about life and a cycle and rebirth. And when we were looking into it, you know, of course we saw it and we were like, oh, that's just an interesting looking symbol. But then when we started researching it, we're like, you know what? Not all of the, you know, this isn't evil, but there are elements of this that really play into who we see the Dread Doctors being. And a lot of it is, you know, I can't really talk too much about it because we'll see what's going to happen later in the season and in the second half of the season. But definitely, you know, things having a cycle and rebirth. But then also the idea that this creature is eating itself. And to what purpose? So it's kind of like, you know, how far are you willing to go to achieve something, you know, and that's kind of that's kind of like, you know, the way we do it on Teen Wolf, where we find something that's real mythology or like this symbol is a real thing that's existed through history, and how do we put our own, you know, stamp on it? And that's basically what we've done with the Ouroboros, working with the Dread Doctors as their symbol.
Because my impression of my first thought about it as well was that maybe, you know, maybe the Dread Doctors aren't as bad as they seem, because I know the Ouroboros isn't inherently evil, but that might be a bit far-fetched in terms of, you know, whether they have a softer side or anything like that, because it doesn't really seem like it at this point.
I think this is interesting, too, because the only other time that I've seen this symbol was on Hemlock Grove. And on Hemlock Grove, it's sort of like, I don't want to say evil, but it's like a bad thing as well. And it's like one of the projects that the scientists are a part of. And so I was like kind of surprised to learn that it wasn't like, you know, an inherently evil thing, just because the only other instance I had seen of it was sort of bad too. But this fact that it represents an internal cycle like a phoenix is really interesting to me, considering what everybody thinks Parrish is. And I'll be curious down the line if at all that could play into it or not.
We'll just have to see.
So basically, Deaton, after he finds his Ouroboros, he finds an experimentation lab with body parts, fetuses worked on in utero, which is really, really gross. Thanks. And a tooth, you know, that has been, I guess, extracted or from something. And he says he's found what he's looking for. So we're not quite sure what that is at this point, you know, evidence of what he suspects the Dread Doctors are doing, maybe. I've got some questions about the fetuses, mainly why. Did you just want to be gross, or is that something that we'll learn about later? Because I've had a couple of theories come up, basically, to do with the very end of the episode, which is the Desert Wolf, first appearance of that lady. She comes and threatens Deaton, basically kills the other dude, threatens Deaton, and asks him about Malia. And he denies all knowledge of Malia, but it turns out that she wants to kill Malia if Malia is still alive, so that the question about why she was shooting at that car is answered. She was actually trying to kill Malia. And the big question is why. Is the, you know, the mother just a psychopath, or does she know something we don't about Malia? Was Malia an experiment in utero that she knows shouldn't be unleashed on the world and that she's trying to do good? That was a theory that that someone on Twitter had. So, yeah, well, you got the kind of the chance to write, I guess, the first scene of the Desert Wolf appearing in the show after speaking about her for so long. Is there any insight you can give us about who she is or what side she's on at the moment?
Those are all great questions, and I can't wait to answer them at a later time.
Wow. You're useless. No. Come on. I'm joking. Well,
you know, as we do with every season, you know, we've got our intellectual villain and our kind of brute strength villain, and they usually, and sometimes they're not always, the stories are running parallel to each other, and then they sort of come together. We'll just have to see what's going to happen with these stories, but all you need to know right now is that the Desert Wolf wants Malia, and she is very capable, and we should be very scared for Malia. So
I think the plot line with the Desert Wolf is so interesting to me because, for one, it's a woman, and, like, she's terrifying. Let's just throw that out there now, especially because she wants to kill her own daughter. And I feel like something else has to be going on with Malia, because if she just, like, didn't want a daughter or whatever, she would have just ignored her. I mean, Malia was probably halfway across the country. I don't know where the Desert Wolf, like, kind of takes up camp, or if she just wanders around anywhere. But Malia was doing her own thing in her own world, had really not too much interest in the Desert Wolf until she learned about her, obviously, and then was kind of going to look for her. But the Desert Wolf could have just remained this elusive character. And instead, she's going after Malia. Like, she didn't kill her the first time, so she's going to kill her the second time. So I just have to think that something else is going on here. It's not just about being crazy and, you know, wanting her dead. There's a reason why the Desert Wolf wants her dead.
And it's, I mean, I'm thinking it's probably tied to the reason why Talia took her away from Peter as well. Like, we originally, like, we was like, is it just because Peter is a crap father? But if Talia took her away and placed her somewhere else and removed the memory of her, maybe it was to stop the Desert Wolf getting the information out of Peter or something like that.
Yeah. No, there's a lot going on behind the scenes here that I can't really talk about
yeah.
yet.
But yeah, this must be so annoying to you. Sorry.
No. It's wonderful, just because I know y'all like the story and you're very interested and definitely invested. So it sucks, because I definitely want to be like, oh my god, here's all this great backstory we've been talking about and all the things that are gonna come later, and of course I just can't tell you anything yet. But we have a whole big deep backstory, and you know, there's a lot going on, a lot of characters involved. You know, a lot of stuff happened 18 years ago, you know, when Malia was born and all this type of stuff. And we're just going to have to wait and see. The Malia Desert Wolf stuff is really a big part of 5B. Mm-hmm. And we're like, 5A is basically laying the groundwork for that. And then it's really going to come to a head in 5B. And that's actually stuff we are going to be talking about today when the writer's room opens up. So it's a lot of good stuff coming.
Cool.
Okay, so let's talk about the sheriff, because he was a huge part of this episode. It was actually really exciting because I love the sheriff and Lyndon is amazing. But he shows up to Melissa's house because she calls him over there and she says, leave your badge at the door. And he's sort of like, you know, physically or metaphorically, and she's like dead serious. She's like both, actually. And it was a really wonderful kind of back and forth, and it was sort of like the tension was already high. And so when he walks in and he sees the body, you can tell like how serious he is, and it actually doesn't take him too long to radio it in. And then, of course, we get the slap, and that was like, whoa, really intense.
It was exciting. I mean,
exciting.
Wonderful.
I don't know. It was. I don't know. I liked it. I liked it because it was less stressful than I thought it was going to be. Like, if you know what I mean. I liked it because it was a heat of the moment situation. But when we saw it in the, you know, things to come in the premiere, I was imagining something much worse. Like, I mean, this is pretty bad. And actually, someone on Twitter said, 2 days later, I could put this in the feedback section, but it's sort of relevant now, said, 2 days on and I'm still super mad at Stilinski. How many times has Melissa violated federal medical privacy laws for him? I think he at least owes her one off-the-books murder investigation, which is possibly true. But yeah, I was just sort of glad it wasn't over something like he'd said something really rude and unforgivable. Like, this is a kind of not a good situation, because she's like, protect the kids, and he's like, I'm going to be the law, But I thought, I was imagining something really nasty. So I'm kind of glad it wasn't something really nasty, but.
Yeah, so am I. I would agree with you that it was less worrying than we had initially thought. I didn't really know what to think to begin with. It was really shocking seeing it in the premiere because you're like, why would she ever slap him? That's so crazy. But it's totally understandable now. I think it was definitely warranted. And I think the best slash worst thing about this whole situation is that I don't know whose side I'm on. I really can't decide because on the one hand, I get what Melissa is asking. I get that she wants to protect her son and all of his friends. And I understand that you can't necessarily go to the law with this person who has the sword sticking out of her chest and these long nails. I mean, clearly something else is going on here and they're not going to be able to explain it. And that's going to open a whole can of worms that nobody wants to open. But on the other side, you have the sheriff who's like, look, this is a person who has died and they have family and friends and we owe it to them to figure out what's going on. And the best way to do this is going to be going through the legal system. And that's the worst part for me is because I can see both sides and I don't think I can choose a side. It's so difficult.
I think with Sheriff and kind of what he tries to pull later with that quote that you mentioned, you know, of Melissa's statement, it's like, how does he expect to swing this if he's not going to tell the whole truth? He says, like, no more bending the rules. But, you know, does he expect to cover up the fact that it's supernatural and just treat it like a murder investigation? Because I don't understand how that's meant to work for him. But, yeah, Will, what side are you on in this argument? Obviously, there's a compelling side for each. But, yeah, what side are we meant to be on, I suppose?
Well, that's a really tough question. And this whole idea, this storyline with Stilinski and what he's going to go through for some of this season is just something that came up in the room because, as you are all very, very well aware, a lot of bodies drop every season on our show. And most of them are hard to explain. Yeah, I know, right? It might be kind of shocking. You might not remember how many people die every year, but but yeah, and that's really where it came from because of course we're a super show. We kind of have to bend the rules. I'm making air quotes as I say that with how things happen legally. And then as we were breaking the season, we were like, well, let's dive into that a little bit, you know, because obviously we have, you know, Stilinski is the sheriff and he has to deal with all of this. So what is it like for him dealing with these types of situations where it's just, what do I write in a report where it's like, oh, a giant monster ate somebody and then someone hit it with their car and now I have to deal with it. You know, it's, you know, what do you do in this situation? And it feels like, and as we're going to see, it seems like Stilinski's kind of reaching a breaking point, you know, where it's like, I can't keep covering this up because like he says, this is a child, you know, this is someone's daughter, you know, what do we say to them? How do we make this right? And how do we deal with these situations inside, you know, the confines of human law? And I guess if I have to choose a side, I can never be against Melissa. So I'm kind of on her side. But I mean, and was the slap warranted? I think it was completely warranted. Was it less worrying than we might have hoped for? I don't think so. Granted, just because that slap could have been the culmination of many different things, but I feel like we got it. I think it's as tough as it needs to be because it's, you know, like she says, our kids get up to things all the time that are beyond the law. And then Stilinski's like, but not above the law. And they're both true. And of course, the best drama always comes from a place when you can see both sides.
Yeah.
And everyone is saying the right thing, but, you know, but it's like, how can I choose? And figuring out, you know, coming up with this, you know, this idea months and months and months ago was just a lot of fun because we, you know, just – I don't remember who it was, but someone was like, well, let's just slap Stilinski. And we were like, oh, okay. Why? And we were like, let's figure it out. Let's find out what. It was just one of those things that just kind of hung in the air, you know, of just, you know, because, you know, when we start the season, it's just everything's on the table and what do we want to see? And that was just an idea that popped up. And we were like, that's – we've never seen that before, and that would just suck a lot, you know, to watch and have to write and deal with. So that means we should probably do it. And it just kind of hung there. And then we found the, and then it just fell naturally into a scene. And we're like, okay, you know, and then of course it got thrown into the season trailer and it just looks even worse. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of a question that, more general about writing an episode, like, and how the writer's room works, because we've tried to puzzle through this a couple of times, but when you're kind of tasked with writing an episode like this, how much of the plot of what actually happens is your personal creation, or how does it work, especially in an episode where there's like quite a few turning points rather than, you know, kind of just a beginning, middle, end, not too much affecting the rest of the show? Because obviously there's a whole, you know, a writer's room, a team of people that are constantly working on the overarching story. And so it's not like you've gone away and written a spec script in a bubble, if you know what I mean. Like, so how much of a plot comes from the head writer? Like, how does someone get the head writer credit on an episode? Like, what are they responsible for doing?
Well, the head writer credit is kind of misleading. That term doesn't really exist. I mean, Jeff is the head writer. He's the showrunner of the show. But as far as authorship over the plot of every episode, the writers as a team break every single episode together. Mm. So when you're tasked with writing the episode, you're not going to be coming up with plot at all, because we break very detailed outlines together. Mm. So I mean, by the time I was given the outline to write, I mean the plot was all there. Like, I mean, because that's just for us the best way to do it, so that the writer never gets lost. You know, because we don't have a lot of time for the writer to go off and write a draft and for us to get it back and be like, oh my god, this is, what if we tried this instead and all this. Like, no, we are under the gun all the time, and it has to be. When the writer gets the outline, it's like, this is the episode you're writing. This is the plot. Here are some bits of dialogue. You know, go make the dialogue your own and put your own spin on the scenes. But this is the plot. What's going to happen? Mm. And we never deviate, really. It's very rare that, I mean, we have in the past a couple of, like, once or twice deviated from outline to script. But I mean, once that outline is done, that is the story from A to Z, and it's time to rock and roll as the writer. So there's really no plot invention. There was no plot invention on my part as the writer. It was just taking the plot that we'd created and just putting my own spin on it and trying to, you know, figure out what the scenes, because we know what the scenes are. It's just how, you know, what's really happening in the scene, because usually in our outline, we know the beginning of the scene and we know the end of the scene. So we know how to get in and how to get out. And then it's kind of all the stuff in the middle where we as writers get to have fun with it and figure out, you know, because we know what the scene's about, we know what's going to happen, and we know what needs to happen. And then it's just, how do we get to make that ours and put our words into it?
Cool. I guess one thing I was curious about in regards to that then, from what you've said, is what scene for you, I guess, changed or surprised you the most coming from the spec to the actual script when you wrote it? Like, what sort of came out that you were like, hey, I didn't know that was gonna go there, or something like that?
Oh boy. I honestly can't remember anything jumping out that surprised me. Usually just because we're running so fast to catch up with what's going on but we're just running so fast to stay ahead of the train that we really don't get surprised when it comes to stuff like that, just because we've broken it so thoroughly by that point that it's we don't really have time to be surprised anymore. And usually if something does change, it's because we've gotten to the script stage, and just as we're usually it's like we've written an episode and we're breaking the next episode, and we realize something that we're doing in the newer episode changes something in a previous episode, and we have to go back before it's shot and kind of clean up that scene or something like that. Because I mean, that's just the process of writing is, like, you know, you can't know everything when you start writing. That would be amazing if we had a year to just write 20 episodes and not worry about when it was going to be shot or anything like that.
Yeah, and then go back.
You know, that would be
the
most amazing.
Oh,
absolutely. And everything could be completely perfect all of the time. Mm-hmm. But sadly, no one in the world who's a TV writer has that luxury. That just doesn't exist. And so, you know, usually as you're moving forward, you're finding little things and having to change things and incrementally. But again, by the time the writer gets to write their draft, it's pretty much set in stone what it's going to be. It's very rare that we get any kind of real surprises.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Karen, do you want to go on with the story?
Yes, and actually I'm really excited that I got this section because I really liked this whole plot line. Actually, I think we all did. But with Kira, we see that she's walking down Highway 115 and she gets picked up by Clark, who's Hayden's sister.
It's a different female deputy.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. As far as I know.
No, it's Clark.
Pardon? No,
it's Clark.
It is Clark.
Yeah, it's Clark.
But Clark's not Hayden's sister, is she?
Yeah, yeah.
That makes no sense to me, because her last name is Clark, and Hayden's last name is Romero.
They do have different last names, and that will be revealed why later.
Okay, so that is meant to be her sister, because I thought there were two female deputies. All right, I have been, and I looked this up, because I was confused. But no, fair enough. All right, good, no problem.
No, it is confusing. There's a whole story behind that. I don't know if now is the best time to get into it.
Okay.
They are sisters, and why they have different last names will be revealed at a later time.
Okay. No, fair enough.
Cool.
I had just looked that actress up, and I was trying to work out if it was the same one. Anyway, sorry, Karen, carry on.
No problem. That's interesting, though. Cool, something to keep our eyes out for. Okay, so she kind of puts her in the back of the car and it tricks her into going in there, really. And this scene kind of made me mad because I was like, Clark, what are you doing? Like, clearly she is kind of not really knowing where she is, what's going on. And she just sort of tricks her into the back of the car. And I was like, she's terrified. Like, you could see on her face that she's terrified and she's confused. And yet, you know, she just throws in the back of the car. But to play devil's advocate, this is potentially a girl that just killed somebody. So I guess I can kind of understand where she was coming from here.
I don't know. Is that legal? Don't you have to tell someone that you're arresting them or, like, taking them into custody? Like, because I liked how nice she was, and then she was obviously already knew that there was a call out for Kira. So anyway, sorry, Will, what were you going to say about it?
Oh, no, I would just say this was my favorite scene in the whole script to write. Just because I love Kira, my absolute favorite character, but it was just an interesting question of how does Clark get her in the car? Mm. You know, because we want it, you know, because clearly it was, you know, Kira doesn't understand what's happening. She's lost, you know, both, you know, physically and metaphorically, sort of. And it's just, how does Clark convince her to get in the car? And that's how we approach every scene, is like, what's the tension of the scene? And the tension is, can Clark get Kira into the car? You know? And so it was just all the different iterations in the room of how she would do it. And then what I wrote, and then when Jeff put his spin on it and what ended up being in the final draft and all that. So it was just a lot of fun, you know, of just, how do you convince someone to do something they might not want to do, you know, or something like that. And of course the scene is very short, but it was just a lot of fun for me.
And surprising, like I wasn't expecting that to happen when
absolutely.
The cuffs slap on her wrist. I was like, wait, what's going on?
That was the whole intention. And when we were writing this scene, it was just like at the very end, it was like, okay, she does get her into the car, and then it was like, and then she handcuffs her to a bar, like, oh my god, what? And then it's like, oh yeah, no, that's great, that's what we should do. And then
it did really startle me.
Okay, so 2 points here that I'm going to kind of bring in, like, a gift set that we'll obviously link to. But the first one is that Styles hears about the murders while he's with Theo. And somebody, Twink Wolf, put together this...
really? Twink Wolf?
Yes,
Jesus,
really.
Christ, this fandom. All right, go with God, Twink Wolf.
They have this gift set, and the first one is from season one when Styles is shoving his mouth full of curly fries, and you know it says like, "We got a report of a possible 187," and he just goes, "A murder?" And then the other one is from this season when it says suspect in 187 is in custody, and he goes, "Homicide," and this time, you know, his face is covered in blood, which is terrifying, and they say, "This is the perfect picture of Stiles Slinsky's character development. Season one, happily nibbling on curly fries, still feeling misplaced excitement over the prospect of a homicide in his town. Season five, exhausted, feeling nothing but icy dread in his heart over the newest murder in Beacon Hills, ignoring the blood spatter in his mouth because he's so used to other people's blood being on his face." And I'm just like, wow. Way to crush my soul.
Yeah. No, I saw that gift set on the Tumblr, and I just loved it. It was because it was perfect. It was just season one, Scott Styles is ready to get out there and to see what's going on. And it's like, oh, my God, there was a murder. Let's go investigate. And now, you know, five seasons later, it's just he's world weary and, you know, it's a murder. And then he hears, you know, Kira's name, and it's just soul crushing. You know, and that's wonderful because I have been seeing a lot recently just kind of dual gift sets of people in the first season or when they were introduced compared to where they are now, and it's just so much fun to see how the characters have changed.
You say fun, I say because I saw one the other day of like it was a comparison between Liam and Hayden and Allison and Scott, and I was just like, wow, why would anybody do this to themselves? Why do you people make these things? Because it hurts so much.
Lots of hurt, lots of feels, but I mean, that's just, that's where the good drama comes from.
That is,
of course, whenever I say something is going to be fun, it's usually going to be terrible, just because for me it's fun to write, and then it's terrible to watch, just because it's Teen Wolf and terrible things happen to the characters we love. But of course, that's the best drama, is seeing our characters put in places we would never want them to see. So,
yeah, that's true.
Fun time.
So much fun. Okay, so we get a quick glimpse of Parrish washing off the soot, and he's called into work by Clark, and I'll get back to that in a minute, but I wanted to talk about Kira and her being brought into the station and her parents coming in and her dad saying that he did it. And at first I kind of laughed because I was like, really? Like, nobody's going to believe this ridiculous story. And that's even, Natalie, that was your quote. So it was sort of funny at first, and then it kept going on, and you could see how serious he was and how he knew it didn't make sense, but it didn't matter.
He was kind of like, try me, come on, you know, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, wow. And then somebody put this up on Tumblr, and it was Big Sky Dreaming, and it says, "Ken Yukimura, ordinary human man, no better prepared to face the supernatural than the sheriff, but who adjusted to it like a boss, who married a woman he knows will outlive him and fathered a daughter destined to do the same, all without begrudging them, envying them, or doing anything other than loving them as fiercely as he can for as long as he gets to, who gave up his own last name so his wife could preserve her identity, who understands that even immortal Kitsune women capable of killing him with their pinky still sometimes need him to protect them, Ken Yukimura, who knows when to stand back and when to step up, ordinary human man so extraordinary that a 900-year-old trickster spirit decided this was the man she wanted to spend the next century with and bear a child together, Ken fucking Yukimura, y'all." And I just got goosebumps reading that because it is so good.
Yeah. I love him a lot. A lot, a lot, a lot. I really, this bit was my favorite, I think, of just both of them just being like, no, and I just loved it. So yeah,
it was absolutely wonderful, because when we were breaking that scene, we were trying to figure out how the scene would play out, and for a while it was if I'm remembering correctly, it was Noshiko who was putting herself on the line, and then at some point we were just like, oh no, it's Ken. Ken, you know, and it's all the stuff that you just said is what we were talking about in the room, is that, yes, human being in a family full of supernatural creatures who will outlive him, and but he loves them both, and he loves his daughter, and will go to the ends of the earth to protect her if he can, you know, and So, and it was just like, all right, you know, Kenyu Kimura with the mic drop, you know, and all this. And that was just, and that was so much fun, because we had so much fun figuring out that scene. And just because, you know, it is, you know, you have a character in a supernatural family, and it's like, when do they get to shine? And then when the scene popped up, we were just like, nope, nope, it has to be Ken. There's no way it can be anyone else, just because, you know, again, he would go to the ends of the earth for his daughter, and he loves his wife, and he loves his family, and it's just, he will do whatever it takes to protect her, and that was a lot of fun. So,
oh, it's so perfect.
Good times.
It was so perfect.
Yeah, it was. Now, something coming back from that is Scott and Kira discuss what happened. She kind of relates it to sleepwalking, which is interesting, and I think that perhaps that's like the spirit taking over, something like that. But she asks him, you don't think it was me, do you? And he hesitates for a fraction of a second, but he hesitates. And he's like, no, and you kind of don't believe him. And now, I don't think this makes Scott a bad person, because it could have been Kira, but it could have been the fox spirit. Like, it doesn't mean Kira is the...
Yeah,
it's not like Kira actually murdered somebody. It was the thing inside of her that caused her to do that. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was interesting because, you know, Nat, you put in here like a rift, because you wonder, you know, this thing is sort of driving them apart, but how far is it going to drive them apart?
Well, out of town, apparently.
Yeah, that's true.
That far.
Yes.
City limits far.
That's how far... Yes, that's how far it drives them apart. And then the episode we are breaking right now is the culmination. Not the culmination of the story, but Kira is the strong A story. And it's what's going on with her, and a lot of good stuff coming. But I can say that, no, Kira and Scott are being driven apart. And that's, of course, on purpose. That wasn't an accident. This whole season is taking Scott to a place he's never been before, and, you know, which is the culmination of the episode, you know, which ends in my quote of the week, which is something has changed, and I think it's my fault. And taking Scott to a place that he's never been before, and taking all the characters to places they've never been before, and how that affects the pack, and how that affects Scott, and what does that mean for everybody? You know, and so, yes, we're driving, you know, we're driving Scott and Kira apart, and you're right, out of town, you know, and, you know, watching her leave in the rain in slow motion and things blowing up and all that, which is fun. But that's, oh, it's just tough. But it's so much fun to write. But I know, I'm the worst.
Did you specially request the Kira drama? Or, like, were you like, hey, can I do the episode where we have the Kira drama? Or did it just turn out like that?
Oh, it just turned out like that because Kira leaving was just this kind of nebulous idea of, you know, because again, we are everything comes back to Scott and how, you know, everything is how does this affect Scott? And then we were like, well, what's the worst thing that could happen? It's like, well, what if Kira left? And it's like that would suck a lot for Scott, you know, and because, you know, it seems like we're whittling him down and. Oh, so much fun to write. It's just terrible to watch because Kira's the best, and she and Scott together is just the best. And it's hard writing stuff for characters you love when it's just going to hurt them. You know, but then at the same time, it's like, this is good drama. I can't shy away from this because it's just good drama, you know? And
yeah.
Good stuff. Good times. Ooh.
What I like about this, too, is, like, it's not just affecting Scott. It's affecting everybody else, too, because now Melissa and Sheriff are being driven apart, too. And we get the scene where she gives her sassy official statement and everything. And, you know, Clark reveals that Theo and Stiles were both at the school the night of the prank call. And we know what goes on there, like what happened, but obviously the sheriff doesn't. And he says, no more bending the rules for anyone, which includes Stiles. And that's when Melissa's like, maybe you should learn to bend a little before somebody breaks. And that just felt like super ominous to me. And now I'm more worried.
He's going to pull up Stiles in a murder trial and stuff. And
yeah.
Because it's almost, we've had this discussion a lot of times about the, you know, the police system and the law, and how, you know, do the people who live within the supernatural, you know, world, like the Argents or like Derek, you know, do they have their own idea of, like, the law? Like, are they, you know, do they actually think that, like, you know, puny human laws, like, apply to them? Or, like, you know, and then how do they, like, end up equating that with, like, you know, do all these superhuman, you know, supernatural people not, like, have, like, IDs and stuff like that? Because, you know, if you know, Styles got pulled up in a trial about Donovan, you know, how would you tell the truth about the trial without, you know, revealing the supernatural to the whole world? So, again, I don't know how Stilinski thinks this is going to work, if you know what I mean. You know, that how he's going to not bend the rules. Like, he's still going to be lying by covering up the supernatural element unless he plans to reveal it to the whole public, which I don't know if that's something that would go so well, but yeah, it just seems a bit unlikely.
Well, that's definitely you know, just a struggle. You know, you're right, is how does human law enforcement deal with the supernatural? You know, because if he, you know, was to bring someone up on real charges and someone was to go to court, I mean, it's like, how do you explain this? You know, it's like, oh, it wasn't me, it was the monster. You know, it's like, does he risk exposing the supernatural world, you know, and stuff like that? And that's definitely, you know, definitely things I thought about in the past, like, especially thinking about Talia when she was, you know, head of the Hale family and all of that, just because, you know, the supernatural creatures are a minority on Earth. You know, they're really, you know, compared to human beings. You know, so it's like I feel like a lot of her tasks dealt with that, you know, because, you know, when we saw her in 308 Visionary, that's what they were dealing with, is like the hunters, you know, came at us and they killed someone and we killed someone in return. And that's the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of supposed to be an eye for an eye type
thing.
But
then what happens when you have to file the official death certificate, you know, with the court, yeah, this human being that was born into a normal system, you know, like. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But
right. Yeah. And so, I mean, and that's just what Stilinski's dealing with now, is like, because it seems like all this is boiling over for him, is like, because I think it's just, especially this season with, you know, who the Chimeras have been so far, you know, it's children, you know, for lack of a better word, that he's been seeing, you know, hurt, killed. And it's just, you know, that adds up. You know, emotionally, you know, and eventually he, you know, like Melissa said, you know, someone might break, and what's going to happen when that happens?
Yeah. And I love that you guys decided to tackle this, actually, because I feel like not a whole lot of supernatural shows do that. I mean, like Supernatural, for example, has been on the air for like 10 years, and you feel like, okay, they've had 10 seasons worth of episodes of all these supernatural things happening. You would think like the entire world would know about this already, and you kind of have to suspend your disbelief a little bit, and I get that, and it's not anything that ever bothered me, but the fact that you guys are tackling like the legal system and what the sheriff is supposed to be doing, because he's kind of split between wanting to do the right thing and wanting to protect those he loves, and obviously not wanting to tell anyone about the supernatural world because it's going to make him sound crazy. But, you know, that's a really difficult plot to explore, and I'm just really glad that you guys decided to do that. I think fans have actually wanted to see that for a while.
Absolutely. And you know, bringing up Supernatural is, you know, very much a procedural show. And when it comes to procedurals, you know, there's kind of like an unofficial reset button at the end of every episode, you know, where there's really not a lot of serialized story. You know, and I know Supernatural has serialized threads that kind of go through the seasons and the series as a whole, but they're nowhere near as serialized as we are. And so when you're kind of in a new town every week dealing with the new vampire monster or whatever, and then you move on to the next town and it's the Loch Ness monster you have to battle, you know, it's like you can kind of get away with all of that. But when you're so serialized the way we are, and every episode of the one that comes next and the one that came before it and all that, there's no way you can just get away with that for forever. And that's definitely something we talked about at the beginning of the season. It's like, it's time for us, you know, it's time for us being Stilinski to deal with this. And how does he deal with it? happen, and what does that mean? You know, and that will definitely play through the rest of this season, and we'll just have to see the good drama that comes from that.
Yeah. Well, finishing up Kira's
plot line. Lots of feels line. Coming, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks. Yeah. Awesome. Finishing up Kira's plot line for this episode, she goes home and she's still struggling with reading the book. She can't get it finished. And her mom comes in and says, read it backwards. And I saw a lot of people were kind of confused by how this would work. I actually found this really interesting, and it made sense to me because if you read it backwards, you're kind of like taking the story in one chunk at a time and then not necessarily reading it, but you're reassembling it in your own head. So it's not like you're actually reading the words from the page in order, because that's what's confusing the spirit. You're reading it in smaller chunks and then reassembling it, you know, kind of abstractly in your mind. And so for me, this made a lot of sense, but I did see that some other people were kind of confused by it. Does that make more sense to you now, Natalie, or are you still struggling with it?
To me, I was kind of like, is it just about kind of, you know, like meditatively looking at the pages and just flicking through it and then sort of having the imagery come up? Or like, I didn't quite follow, so I don't know. Will, what was this situation with the reading the book backwards?
Yeah, that came about because Kitsune's are tricksters, and there's this myth. Is it a myth? I'm not sure exactly what to call it. But when a lot of people, when a lot of Japanese people answer the phone, they say moshi moshi.
Yeah.
And that's because there is the because Kitsunes are tricksters, and they are not very good with language. So if you give them something that's kind of a language problem, it trips them up, and that's how you'd know if you were talking to a Kitsune. So if someone you know, someone calls you and you answer moshi moshi, and there's kind of a stutter on the other end, it's like, oh, it must be Kitsune calling you, and you should just hang up the phone. And and that's
a common problem,
right? And so Right, and that was something we tried to get into season 3B, but it just never, you know, it just didn't work out. And then when we had the Dread Doctors, because Valak used, he wrote it in such a way that pattern recognition would be part of it, and how it would kind of unlock things inside you, because the book is basically one big word jumble, you know, and that's throwing Kira off, that because it's kind of a language problem, it's kind of messing up the Kitsune inside of her. And and so when Nishiko was like, you know, read it backwards, it was very much what Karen said, where it's take it one piece at a time. You're not looking at it as a story anymore, because, you know, if you're reading it straight through, it's like this is a story you're seeing. But when you read it backwards, it's just blocks of text that you can take in kind of one little piece at a time. It's kind of like some drawing teachers, like some art teachers, will say, if you're if you're having trouble drawing something, turn it upside down, and then your brain doesn't see
it as what, an apple or a wine bottle or something. Just like do the shapes. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, not an app anymore. It's just lines, because your brain is saying, when it's turned upside down, your brain isn't I mean, you know it's an apple, but your brain isn't looking at it and going, oh, that's an apple. It's just lines and shape. And then when you turn the picture right side up, oh, look, it's an apple, and you're able to draw it, you know? And it's basically like that. So reading it backwards, taking it one sentence and one paragraph at a time, she's just able to break the information down into more manageable chunks for her and the Kitsune inside of her. But of course, then that unlocks mysteries and memories that she didn't realize she had. And,
which took place on 115, so now we know what the acupuncture needles were spelling out and everything. And we see the Dread Doctors put her on the hood of the car and inject her in the eye, which I know a lot of people were like terrified of. And she sort of like lightning strikes, and like there's this blinding light that comes out of her mouth or something, and something crazy went on. And I have a feeling that maybe it could have been a distraction, perhaps, to kind of give them something else to deal with while they were fighting the Dread Doctors, like Scott and everything, and, you know, okay, now we have to worry about Kira, or perhaps it had something to do with unlocking her abilities so that they could get into Eichen House. I'm not really sure, but definitely going to be curious once we do figure out what's going to happen, and maybe that's going to be a little while. We don't really know because, you know, she has to leave in order to fix her problems. And, you know, she talks to Scott about doing that, and he still can't, like, tell her what's going on with her. Like, he kind of refuses to say, yes, you look like a giant fiery fox demon now, and it's terrifying. So they kind of... they leave, and Natalie wrote in here, another flash forward on our bingo sheet. So, yes, that is correct.
Yeah. I found that really weird that he, like, both originally when he wouldn't... the big thing that I've had all season with Scott and Kira is why wouldn't... when she originally asked him, she knew there was a problem with her going on. She's like, hey, look at me with your eyes. Tell me what you see. I know there's a problem. And he still wouldn't tell her. And then even this time, you know, that they were clearly both knew there was a problem and he still couldn't vocalize it. But why wouldn't he tell her? Like, when back when she originally asked, when she clearly knew there was a problem, why wouldn't he admit it to her?
For me, it's there's a lot of, a big part of this season is the things we don't say when we should, you know. And the first time Kira asked him to look at her to see what her spirit was up to, and he saw the spirit, and the spirit pointed at her sword, and he didn't say anything. For me, it's because we all go through things like that. You know, I mean, that's just a universal thing, is that, you know, there are things we should tell people that we don't. And in Scott's case, in that moment, the reason he didn't say anything was because he was scared of what would happen. You know, he was scared of the repercussions of what could come from it, you know. And it was that fear that held him back, you know, that he said everything was okay. Because it's kind of like, if I say everything's okay, maybe everything will be okay, you know. So it is a form of, you know, just kind of self-denial. But also it's, if I say her spirit is bigger than I've ever seen it before, and it's pointing to things, it's communicating with me, you know, what does that mean? And it's probably really bad, and I'm going to lose Kira, you know. And so I feel like... you know, that's just a human thing, and taking Scott to that point is great, because of course we now have the culmination of that scene where he looks at her again and the fox is even bigger and even more fiery, and then, oh my god, I have to say, that shot just broke my heart. Because, you know, you see Kira through the spirit, and she is just so sad that she knows he is seeing something terrible, and just broke my heart. And yeah, so I mean, of course, he, at that moment, he should have been like, oh my god, babe, there's this, oh my god, the spirit, it's, you know, pointing to things. You know, of course, he should have done that, but then who knows what could have happened after that. She might have left, or it could have just been, you know, more immense danger, you know, coming immediately. So it's just, for me, it was Scott's fear of the unknown and Scott's not wanting to lose her that kept him from saying anything. But of course, you know, we are taking Scott to places he would never go before. I feel like in a previous season, had that happened, he'd be like, holy shit, we need to, pardon my friend.
No,
you know, he would be like, oh my god, we need to, you know, we need to deal with this. We need to go find Deaton and he'll know what's up, or let's go talk to you know, Noshiko, she'll know, yeah. You know, but now it's just because everything is falling apart, you know, that he's like, if I say what's happening, I could lose her too. And then, of course, that's what does end up happening. And it's terrible and sad, but good drama.
It's been, it's just been bothering me all season. Yeah. I mean, I know it's part of his whole thing, but it's just, I'm just like, why would you do that? Why would you do that? But anyway, moving on from that, the police decide that they're going to guard the hell out of this body, because apparently they know at this point that people are taking the bodies. So they're going to guard it, and they're going to try and catch who's taking the bodies. Unfortunately, they give Parrish the very important job of guarding the morgue door, which is just like...
I laughed through this entire scene. Oh, I was dying. It was so funny because he's so serious about it. And I was like, dude, this is not going to work out the way you're hoping it will.
I don't know if I laughed through the scene, but yeah, so that was a bit of a rookie mistake anyway. But before we get to sort of the outcome of that, Styles comes to the hospital to tell his dad to just leave it alone, to let the person whoever wants to take the body, because he knows the risk, he knows how powerful the body snatcher is because he's just experienced it the night before or however long that previous episode was. And him and his dad sort of start bickering about the, you know, the choices that Stilinski is making about his work. And he kind of, something sort of triggers Stilinski's memory, like someone's hospital pass, to ask Stiles about the key cards that Clark mentioned earlier. And Stiles flat out lies to his face, like, you know, just saying, oh, yeah, like, we do have that. I'd let you see mine, but I lost it a couple of weeks ago. A couple of questions about this for you, Karen. Number one, you know, do you think that Stiles had pre-prepared this lie, or do you think that this was in the moment, like, oh, shit, key cards, and automatically just lied that fast?
I kind of think he automatically lied that fast. I think he's getting really good lying to his father, like he said previously, and the fact that it came off so seamlessly without any hesitation really kind of worries me.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think Sheriff believed him, or do you think he was like, about it?
That's really hard to answer. I kind of want to say that I think the sheriff believed him just because it did come off without any hesitation, and, like, it was a really, like, the lie made sense. But at the same time, I think the sheriff is kind of reevaluating everything and everyone around him. And I wouldn't be surprised if he was like, all right, I believe you now, but, like, I'm going to still check into this. So
I don't know.
We'll see what happens.
I kind of think he didn't, or I kind of felt like he didn't, because I feel like the fact that he even asked, the fact that he was like, hey, key cards, hey, my son, hey, was my son there? Like, the fact... He asked because he was suspicious, if you know what I mean. It wasn't just a like, hey, tell me stuff about your school. It felt suspicious to me, but I don't know. Maybe yeah. I'm reading it wrong. And then we see Stiles, you know, a few moments later, kind of fiddling with his key card with his name on it and his first initial, which is like people are making an incredibly big deal out of. At this point, I'm so tired of, like, caring about what Stiles' name is that it's not even funny, but I don't know if it's going to be relevant, but there we go. There it is. And I'll bug Will about that in 1 second. But, yeah, he kind of plays with the card and then tosses it out, like, oh, shit, you know, we've got to, you know, get rid of that. So, yeah, I don't know, just I feel like that, you know, this is more and more of Stiles just being, you know, going off last week's episode where he kind of admitted that he didn't really care about what he'd done. He just sort of cared about the consequences of it, which I kind of love that aspect of the character. But yeah, Will, what's your opinion about that kind of dynamic between the sheriff and Stiles at the moment? I mean, what was the aim there to imply, I guess?
Well, I definitely think we're definitely trying to get across, and I hope successfully, that the dynamic between Stiles and his dad is just becoming more strained, where in the past, you know, Stiles injecting himself into things, was hard for Stilinski, but it was never this hard. You know, like, things are just everything in everyone's lives is just kind of coming to a boiling point, and that includes between Stiles and Stilinski, and there's just a lot going on that Stilinski doesn't know about. And you know, of course, Stiles is just trying to figure things out and to make things right. But it's just, again, it was cute for a while, and then it was kind of frustrating, and now it's just becoming a problem, you know. And that's where, you know, where we're trying to take, I think, Stiles and Stilinski, just because it just feels like such a natural progression of everything that's happening this season. And, you know, it sucks, you know, just because, you know, it's always fun having Stiles and Stilinski. They have such a wonderful relationship, and it could get bad. Who knows?
I feel like finding out that Stiles was, you know, around that death, like whether it's a murder or whatever you want to call it, that he was there for it, you know, and finding out he's kind of feelings on the matter, I suppose, probably would be a hard thing for, you know, parent to deal with, you know, especially that he didn't come to him. Like, I wonder if Sheriff would have, you know, bent the rules in that circumstance, or, you know, whether he would have, you know, how he would have dealt with it, basically. But Other question is, do you know Styles' name? You don't have to tell us. But do you guys know what it is? Or is this important for some reason? Or is it just there's the key card and we needed to see that it was the key card?
I do not know what his name is, sadly. And Jeff lords it over us every now and then.
What a weirdo.
That sounds like him.
No. Because we were breaking this scene. We were like, you know, we knew from the start of the season as we were breaking kind of the trajectory, we were like, you know, key cards are going to be important and you know, just because of access to certain places and how maybe that can become evidence. And we were like, okay, well, on the key card, it can't just say Stilinski. And he was like, maybe it'll just say Stilinski, or maybe his thumb will cover the first initial or, you know, and then he was like, and then at one point he was like, do y'all want to know what the name is? And we were like, yeah, and he goes, okay, I'll tell you. No, I can't tell you. And they were like, damn it, Jeff. And then he was like, okay, fine. And he just wrote, he goes, okay, the first initial is M. And we were like, and what are the remaining letters in that? And he was like, oh, I can't tell you. And he was like, it's very Polish, lots of consonants. And I was like, fine. Hmm. You know, so one piece at a time, hopefully.
Why
who knows, maybe by
so
whenever.
I don't understand why it's such a big deal at this point. I think it's just because it's been a big deal for so long, but yeah.
Yes, I think it's just because it's been such a big deal for so long that it's just, you know, just keep it going and you know, just because, I mean, it's one of the things like, you know, once everyone knows what the name is, it won't be as interesting anymore. You know, I mean, you know, so it's just one of those things that just lasted for so long that it's just, you know, let's just keep this little fun mystery going and see what happens with it. But
people are really hung up about it. Like, I think there was like an MTV article discussing it today, like how they do their reaction articles to the episodes. There was a whole reaction article about the name, and I'm like, yeah. You know what, Styles, what his Christian name is like the least interesting thing about this character, especially right now. Like I'm not saying that it isn't the thing that like people get excited about, because it is, but I'm like, do you know how much more this character has going on besides from like not knowing what his Christian name is? Because there's a lot, and people are so hung up on this, and it's just like, I don't know. I care, but I'm also like amazed that it's a thing that we care about so much, I suppose. Karen, were you excited?
Yeah.
I kind of didn't notice at first. I honestly thought it said Mr. Stilinski, and I was like, that's kind of weird, but like, whatever, it is what it is. And then later on Tumblr, I saw the M. Stilinski thing, and I was like, oh, that was the thing I was supposed to pick up on. Great.
Anyway, never mind. More importantly than that,
I had this headcanon that who knows how this show is going to end, but if there were ever a graduation scene, I would love, you know, where everyone's kind of walking across the stage and they get the Stilinski and the principal or whoever is like, Style Stilinski, everybody.
Yeah.
I don't know. That might be just too much, but
yeah. Maybe we'll see it for the first time on his grave when he ends up getting killed.
Oh, that's terrible,
but it's possible. Anything.
I think we might have discussed this before, actually.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, we have good times here. Anyway, moving on from that.
Oh, my God. I said we would break the internet if that happened.
Yeah,
oh, my
yeah.
God.
Well, you heard it here first, guys. But, you know, we'll see. Probably not. But anyway... Moving on from that, the morgue parish, you know, basically does his thing and becomes fiery parish, attacks a lot of cops. He's kind of in a weird trance and tells the sheriff to leave. And, you know, sheriff gives him a bit of a suspicious look. And the Stilinski father and son discover that the body is missing. We don't see a massive result of, you know, Parrish carrying it out, but we see, you know, him, you know, attack quite a few people, send off the fire alarms and cause a big diversion. And then at the end of it, you know, they find Parrish's burnt badge, and Styles tells Lydia that, so they know it's Parrish now, basically. So I guess they must have seen him, you know, or worked it out. And Lydia remembers his Nematon dream and says, I think I know where he's taking him. And the thing about this that surprised me is that Lydia didn't suspect him before now because she knew about the Nemeton dream and about him carrying bodies already, but I guess it isn't necessarily something that you'd put together. But Karen, had you noticed that at all?
Noticed which part?
Well, I can't remember if we talked about it or not, that Lydia should have or could have noticed before now.
Oh, well, I mean, to be fair, I think she's been kind of distracted by everything that's going on. But, I mean, I don't think having dreams about that necessarily equates to being the person that stole the bodies. Mm. Maybe once... Well, no. I was going to say maybe once they found out that the person who was stealing the bodies had some sort of control over fire, but I don't think either Theo or Styles knew that. They knew, like, they didn't know where the fire came from. That was specifically said. Yeah. So maybe if they had had that connection, Lydia could have figured it out sooner, but I don't think it's, like, weird that she didn't.
Mm. Anyway, they know it's him now, so... And they, you know it's probably not him of his own volition, so hopefully they'll deal with that soon.
Yeah. Well, another huge part of the episode was the search party for Liam and Hayden, and we see Scott and Malia trying to track them down, and they fail, so Scott goes home, and he just barrels through the house. And he sticks his claws into Corey's neck to get his memories from them, from him. And this is something that we haven't really seen from Scott before, this sort of, like, ruthlessness. It was very non-consensual, and it was very desperate. It seemed very desperate to me. And... You know, I wanted to know, Will, like, what was it like to write that? Because Scott is a character who is so, so, so good. I mean, he's been so good from the very beginning. We're finally starting to see what he's like when he gets desperate and he's kind of losing his hope in the situation. And what sort of things did you talk to Posey about to kind of make this scene come off the way that it did?
Well, definitely, you know, as we've been building this season, it's pushing Scott further and further and tearing him down piece by piece, you know, and eventually, because he's always cool, calm, and collected, you know, and what he did to Corey is something he never would have done in the past. But like you said, we're seeing Scott in a very desperate place. You know, I think it was in the previous episode, you know, where someone said, we're losing and we don't even know if the game is. You know, and that is what's happening. You know, there's so much going on, and Scott is, for once, I mean, he's always out of control when it comes to the story, because, you know, there are forces, you know, aligning against him and all of that. But this is the first time that it's really starting to take its toll on him, and that they're losing, and he is tired of people dying, and he's tired of not being able to help, you know, to always be one step behind and all that. And it's just this complete desperation on his part that drove him to do it, that drove him to do something he would never, ever, you know, even consider doing. And it was tough writing the scene, you know, and breaking the scene was tough, just because it's like, you know, how far can we take Scott before he becomes unlikable? Or, you know, what's the real truth of this moment, you know, like, where, how do we find that? And a lot of that, we talked to Posey about that, and he was, he loved playing all of this, because it's, again, we are showing, you know, Posey the actor and the audience and us as the writers, we're showing a side of Scott we've never imagined possible, just because we've never seen him this low and this desperate. So it was tough to write, and it was tough to figure out, you know, that this is something we were going to do. But at the same time, I mean, this all comes back to Scott's character, and it all comes back to the journey he's on this season, and just how hard it has been for him and how hard it will continue being for him. And it's just really just getting, you know, the heart of the matter being just how desperate he is to not lose anyone else and the lengths he'll go to save lives.
Yeah, and I love the consequences of this action, too, in terms of Lydia being so disapproving of what he's doing. I think that, you know, she's really the only one that says something to him about it. And you can tell that she's just not cool with it. And I don't think Scott is necessarily cool with it either, but he kind of was like, this is just the line that I have to cross in order to get Liam back, and this is what I have to do. And while he felt uncomfortable doing it, you know, he kind of knew this is what had to be done, whereas Lydia, I think, would have liked to have taken another route, but he didn't really give her that chance. And then on the flip side of that, you see Theo, who's so curious about the entire thing, and you can just see him plotting and scheming, and I was like, what are you up to?
Well, I was curious that, you know, Lydia said, you know, it's usually only alphas do, and I was like, but Scott is an alpha. Like, is she trying to warn Theo off from trying it, or, like, what was that situation?
I was just going to say, it kind of does sound like she was warning Theo from that, because obviously they know that Scott is an alpha, so yeah. He can do something like that. I mean, he didn't have a whole lot of practice, but, yeah, maybe she's just like, don't try this at home, kids.
Yeah. PSA.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that shot of Theo seeing this for the first time, I mean, you just see that shot and you're like, that's probably not good, you know, and you know, just because, I mean, Cody is so good at playing bad. He's such a nice guy. He's such a good, fun person to be around. But then, you know, when the director calls action, he turns into Theo, and I hope he's not taking anything away from this, but you know, it's just, not good things. Not good things. But then also, I think part of what that shot you see of Theo is he is like, because he has a front row seat to Scott breaking, you know, and he's just kind of like, you know, I wish I had some popcorn to watch this.
No. Yeah.
You know, no. And stuff like that, you know, and so, good stuff. Good, terrible stuff.
Yeah. And speaking of Theo, you know, we see Scott figure out where Hayden and Liam are, and they, you know, sort of goes off and, like, Scott's going to go, Malia's going to go, Mason's going to go. Lydia's like, no thanks. And they kind of want Theo to go with them because they could use the manpower and everything, but Theo wants to stay behind, and I'm like, okay, this is obviously a very calculated move, and I knew right from the very beginning that this was going to have some sort of consequence. I did not know what he was necessarily going to do with it, but and I wonder if maybe he had other plans or he was open to what was going on, but I think it's really interesting that he was like, nah, I'm going to stay here. You guys go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't quite sort of parse why exactly he didn't want to go. Like, obviously, except for to orchestrate what ended up happening, I wasn't really sure why he didn't want to go, except for that maybe, you know, if the Dread Doctors saw him and then he was with them and he might get revealed. I don't know. I was a bit confused by it, but I did wonder if he kind of had everything set up for later, or if he just knew that he could get more out of Corey than Scott could, like that he's setting himself up for, like, the position that he kind of gets later, which we will talk about when we get there in a minute.
Yeah.
Right. With Theo, I mean, really he's one step ahead, or in some cases, many steps ahead, you know? And for me, that moment was just, cause he kind of has an idea how things are going to play out, you know, or how they should play out. And, but then I feel like, you know, Scott, you know, clawing Corey was just such an interesting new moment for him that I think that moment where he's like, I'm going to stay, was just him shifting gears a bit and just repositioning himself to see, because he's like, this is information I need to deal with.
Yeah, because if we're looking at it the perspective of, like, say he always knew where Hayden and Liam were, like, say he knew where they were the whole time because of what he knows about the Dread Doctors, that means he has to orchestrate a way to get the correct information about where they are, rather than just being like, oh, I found them. How did I find them? I found them. You know, like, he has to get the information.
Of course.
So it looks like that he found them from information that he had, and you know, he knew that the first answer Scott got was wrong, I guess. And then, you know, he had to basically get the information from Corey and pretend like he didn't know it already if he didn't know it already. So, yeah, I don't know.
This is just Right. No. That's it. It's Theo positioning himself to look amazing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Scott, you know, and so that's of course. I mean, once you've watched the episode, you're like, that's what this was. Yeah. Was how do I? How do I look like a hero?
The hero of the hour. You know? Yeah. Exactly.
And as exactly, much as I right, hate you know, Theo. He is so good at adapting, you know, he is a good bad guy, he's very intelligent, and that just makes it so frustrating, because you want the heroes to win, obviously.
Right, exactly. He's definitely one of my favorite bad guys so far, just because he's able to just see what's happening, and because he's orchestrating things so well, he can just position himself in such a way to look amazing, or to not be noticed, and it's again, whenever Theo is doing something... it's just how is this going to be terrible for Scott and the pack, you know, because clearly he has an agenda, you know.
I'm still going back and forth about what it is, but yeah.
Well, he has an agenda, that's all I can say. And he has a goal, and he is very smart, and he knows how to get what he wants, and he's just got a long game running, and we're just sadly going to have to sit through more episodes to see what the culmination of it is, and what that means for Scott and the pack, you know? So yeah, good times to come.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I want to say about this scene, you know, other than we see Theo figure out where, you know, he already knew, but figure out where, Hayden and Liam were, and he kind of goes after them. It's where the Rave Wolf came through the wall and all of that. And we get Mason, Malia, and Scott still being unable to find Liam. They kind of leave, you know, Scott is still having trouble. He needs his inhaler and everything. He blames himself for everything, and they leave and they don't notice the Ouroboros. But the other thing I want to mention is this other gift set that we found, and it is this, it's like Malia Styles and Lydia. And in the first one, it's from season 4 when Malia's like, I would never leave without you. And there's a shot of Lydia who's like not rolling her eyes, but kind of looking away and something. And then you see from this episode, Styles saying to Malia, text me for anything at all, okay? And Lydia kind of has this look on her face again. And obviously it's like a Stydia thing. And I hadn't picked up on it before. Don't know if it's intentional. Probably can't say anything about it if it was intentional, but I like this idea that perhaps, you know, Lydia is sort of secretly developing feelings for Styles, and she's not going to say anything to him because she knows how he feels about Malia, and she's not going to step in, but it doesn't mean she has to be happy about it. And I just thought it was a nice little parallel. Did you notice that at all, Natalie?
I didn't. I only saw it in the gifs, but it kind of did bring up the question. When I rewatched the episode, I kind of was looking out for it, and I'm not sure if it was in reaction to what Styles said specifically, or if it was kind of her reaction to just the situation of, wow, you're a bunch of idiots, this is not going to go super well. But I actually was thinking about it, and was thinking about asking Will, not about the Cydia aspect or anything like that, but about when a script, you know, when you write a script like this, like how much, I want to say stage direction. You don't call it stage directing in screenwriting, but like how much do you write down so-and-so should have this expression on their face at this time? If you like, how much direction is written in the script in terms of non-verbal acting and stuff like that?
Well, we definitely, you know, when the actor or anyone reads the script, you need to be able to understand what's going on in the scene and definitely understand kind of the headspace of each of the characters. Mm-hmm. But we don't write it so detailed that that means that there isn't room for improvisation or discovery on the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, we shoot so quickly that, you know, we don't have time, you know, we don't spend a whole day on each scene. You know, we don't have time to do that. But the scenes are written in such a way that, you know, we know what the story beats are, but there's still room for interpretation, you know, so that the director and the actors and the writer on set can kind of tweak the scene as they're going. And really, as they're filming, you're making kind of like the second to last pass of the scene, because the last pass come in editing, you know.
but there's still a little bit of room for interpretation and tweaking lines and figuring out exactly what everyone's headspace is. But there is always enough on the page for you to understand what's going on, just for clarity's sake.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right, I'm just going to rush through the Liam and Hayden's sort of experience, because it was more just little shots of what was happening to them while they were waiting to get rescued. In that, like, Liam was, like, bolted down through his arm. I don't even know what was going on with that. Like, I couldn't – there was too much black blood. I couldn't work out exactly what was happening. And then after they sort of operated on Hayden, she was tossed aside with a wound, and her and Liam sort of left on the floor. He tries to take her pain, and then they get – put in the reject basement, basically. They knock them out and they get put in the reject cave, the reject basement, where they meet Zach, who had wings, and he had a very kind of what?
I freaked out at the wings. Everything else that we've seen so far in this entire season, you know, needles in the eyeballs, totally fine with. The wings, I like screamed. Like, I don't know why, but it creeped me out.
I thought it was sad. Wings being cut off is that's super awesome. Sad. And I can't work out whether that kid is like meant to be this, like, you know, demented but, you know, very innocent presence, or whether he was like a, you know, menacing presence, because I found like a really weird kind of spacey innocence about him, but it also could have been like, I'm totally evil. So he sort of served to explain, like, what's happened. Like, he's seen people come and go from the room, like, failures and stuff like that, and then he ends up getting dragged off. He gives them a bit of information about their situation and then gets dragged off himself. I kind of liked him, but was he there sort of just for exposition in, like, telling them what was going on, or is there something more to that?
Well, he's just you're asking, like, is he crazy or evil? For me, I just saw him as just being an unfortunate victim, you know, and I love Karen, that the fluttering of the wings freaked you out, because that's definitely what we wanted. That came up in the room where we were gonna see, he turns around and we see that he just has stumps of wings, they were removed, and then someone was just like, they should flutter, and we were all like, yeah,
you guys
immediately
suck.
Wrote it in and like, but yeah, that's what should happen.
It was sad, but it was really kind of gross, too.
That's sad and gross.
Yeah, true.
Teen Wolf in a nutshell.
So, right, exactly. But you're thinking about the information he gives. I mean, that's just important information in that all of the pack has just been operating kind of at a deficit where they don't know what's happening. Mm-hmm. And we were like, now we want to give them some information that will be important, you know, so they – hopefully, you know, because with this information, maybe they can get a win out of it, you know, because the more information our pack has, you know, the better they are, the better they will be at trying to stop the Dread Doctors. So hopefully this information will be helpful to them at some point.
Mm. Yeah, true. And then, you know, they're kind of being like, oh, they called us failures. Doesn't it make you wonder what success is going to look like? You know, big question, what are the Dread Doctors aiming for? Like, what are they trying to create? If the kind of the monsters are failures, I guess, that, you know, all of the ones that have failed, I'm trying to work out whether they're ones that are just, you know, where the situation hasn't taken, like, you know, if it's like, oh, the transplant thing didn't work and the person is dying, or if it is just that they didn't work the way they wanted them to. And, you know, since everyone they've created so far is like a crazy monster, pretty much, then what do they want? Are they trying to aim for something better or something worse, like something more dangerous, or are they trying to make something quote-unquote nice and it keeps messing up? They look like people who want something really nice, don't they?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. No, not at all. Not at all.
Success for the Dread Doctors probably isn't going to be great for anybody. Because they're just making monsters, and if we're seeing the failures, oh boy, who knows how bad the success could be.
Mm. Yeah, that's basically what I was going to say, too. You know, what constitutes as a success for them? Have we seen a success? Because obviously there are theories about Malia and Theo as well, and what that means. And, you know, do we know the full extent of their abilities if they are successes? So, yeah, it's, you know, whatever success is, I don't think it's going to be good for, like, anybody, except for maybe the Dread Doctors.
times.
So the last part of the episode is we basically get the results of everything. Theo ends up finding Liam and Hayden. He electrocutes himself on the fence and then rips it down in order to get to them. And I'm just like, wow, you have such devotion to this lie that you are keeping up, that you are willing to electrocute yourself in order to get to these people that you know full well that your bosses basically kidnapped. So Theo is nothing but thorough, I would say.
Yes, he is incredibly thorough. And again, he is just ahead of everybody. And it's how, you know, every move he makes is how will this make me look even more awesome in the eyes of everybody, and makes Scott look not great at all. And no, you're right. You know, it's what are the lengths we're willing to go to get what we want. Mm. And Theo knows what he wants. And he will, it seems, go to the ends of the earth to get it.
Yeah. Well, he drives the kids home and they sort of make out in the back of the car, which I actually thought was really adorable. And Liam ends up taking Hayden's pain through kissing, which I thought was also really adorable. I really like those two.
So much adorable.
Yeah. Wow. It was awesome. But, you know, then they go home and Scott returns and everything, and Theo is there and he's greeted as this hero, which I just hated. But Natalie, you have a very important part to talk about that I actually did not pick up on.
Well, it's just this moment where it just messed with me. Because there's this moment where basically, you know, Scott comes back and Scott's kind of holding his hand down low for the low dude handshake. And Theo's like clings to him like, oh, I came back. I'm so, like, he kind of clings to Scott like he's grateful for Scott, like he hugs him. And I know it was probably some like gross manipulative thing. Like he then hugs everyone else, like, you know, Mason and Malia and stuff, but I don't know, I just had a lot of feelings about it. Like, it was so good. Like, he was manipulating me. I was like, what does he want? Like, why is he doing this? Like, is this, you know, is any of this real? Like, you know, is, you know, does he have emotions inside him that are trying to get out? You know, like, or just all of this nonsense, which probably isn't true at all. But just the fact that he was kind of elevating the emotional investment. Like, he was so relieved to see Scott, or, like, you know, that he was kind of acting quote-unquote humble about it by, you know, he wasn't being like, yes, look at me. He wasn't being like, yes, I've done well. He was kind of like, I was so scared, I need a hug, or whatever it was. I don't know, it just messed with me. Like, I was almost weepy about it, because if that was any other circumstance where it wasn't an evil sociopath, like where if it was just two people and someone went in for a handshake and the other one went in for a hug and then they were, and it was that desperate, I would be like sobbing. Like, if that was between two characters who were actually legit and one wasn't Theo, if you know what I mean. So I had a lot of feelings about pulling that move, basically. So thanks a lot for that, Will.
I actually had a lot more feelings about Malia and Theo hugging, because, you know, he was sort of manipulating her a few episodes ago and being like, I'm not going to tell Scott. And, you know, there are a lot of things I want to do, and I want to be a part of this pack and all this stuff. And then for the fact that she hugged him, she was willing to hug him, like, made me worried that maybe, you know, she's trusting him a bit more and all of that, and just, ugh.
I feel like it was a big moment of, like, you know, I'm here for all of you, all I care about is you guys and stuff like that, basically. Like, that's kind of how I feel about what he's doing, that he's really trying to push how much, you know, how he's just a little, all he wants is to just be a little piece of the pack, and he really loves them all and stuff like that. Ugh.
Oh yeah, Theo is nothing if not a master manipulator, and everything he's done is thought out to have, you know, as much
emotional
personal
effect
as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And as far as like what you said, having feelings about, you know, Scott goes for the handshake and Theo goes for the hug, it's just no. When I saw that too, I was just like, I don't, this isn't good, this can't be good, you know. But for me, it was just like, for my headcanon, it was just, you know, he's hugging Scott and he's saying, he's almost saying, I've got you, you know, like, it's okay, I've got you. But yeah, then the other half of me was saying, I've got you.
you know.
And,
so
I just got goosebumps when he said that. And,
no, that's just the way I imagined it in my head because of the way he plays it, you know. And it's just, it's just everything has double meanings, you know. When he does anything that means two things, and then just hugging Scott is just,
yeah. I've had a lot of suspicions.
So much going on, and
this is probably really wrong, but I've mentioned this on a couple of the past episodes. Is that I have these? I don't know what he wants with Scott. I don't know if he secretly really hates Scott, or if it's like one of those characters where the character is totally evil, but they're really obsessed with the person in a good way. Like how Jennifer Blake was really in love with Derek, I guess. I'm like, is this guy really in love with Scott, like, and evil, or is he like fucking over Scott as well? And that's been my big thing. About what he wants with Scott, basically. But I did get curious, if Scott seeing how Theo handled the situation, if he's like, oh, maybe Theo should lead my pack. But then, you know, if people are thinking, oh, maybe Theo's the better leader. Look at how competent and great he is, and I'm falling apart. And then Karen put the opposite, like, and asked if he seemed suspicious of Theo, which I didn't pick up on at all. So what was that, Karen?
It was just the look on Scott's face. I don't know if it was, like, shell shock coming home to, like, Liam being there and everything's fine and, like, you know, Theo's the hero, or if it was, like, it felt too convenient that Theo was able to get to Liam. I mean, Scott's been Team Theo from the beginning. You know, he's always really wanted to give him a chance. It was Styles who was the one that didn't trust him from the get-go. And so I don't know, but this idea of him, you know, wondering if Theo will be a better leader, or maybe wondering if the team will elect him the next leader or something, really has me worried, because, you know, that thought is just going to drive Scott further and further away from everybody else, and that is obviously a theme of this season so far.
Yeah, fun times, good, excellent news. And then, obviously, it's sort of the last talking point. I mean, it ends with the Deaton thing that we've already talked about, but the last talking point is Scott, you know, with his sad dog leash, you know, living his depression life on the floor.
Which is something we haven't really seen from Scott before. Like, I mean, this is him at his lowest, and it's really hard to watch.
It's hard to write, too. This isn't fun, you know. I mean, we don't revel in. Okay, all right. It's a little fun, but no. I mean, we don't revel in taking Scott to these places. But it's just, it all comes from character, you know. Where it's like he's dealt with so much over these last five seasons that this is a new thing, you know. And we can't rest on our laurels and do the same thing every season. We have to find new places to push the characters, and I mean, that can't always be a good thing, you know. I mean, they have to grow and learn, and for someone to grow and learn from something, you've got to, you know if you're going to build a character back up, you have to break them down first, you know. So
I'm just curious why he suspects.
It's not fun, but it's drama.
I'm just sort of curious as to why he thinks that, except for the mindset, I guess, of being that down and just thinking everything's because of you. I'm wondering what kind of factual evidence he has that that everything is happening because of him, or is that just because he's only thinking that because he feels so bad? I'm sort of wondering why he's making those conclusions.
Well, for me, it's because, you know, after watching that scene where everyone's hugging and all that type of stuff, Scott is very pretty much the odd man out.
Yeah, he was like, I couldn't do anything.
And exactly. And I feel like anyone who's put in that situation where they're, you know, on the outside looking in, I think the natural conclusion is it must be me. I must have done something wrong, you know, because everything seems to be fine over there, but things are broken with me. So I must have done something. What is it that I've done? How have I created this problem? I think that's just a human way of looking at things, you know, and because human beings are complicated, and facts and evidence don't always play into our thinking, you know, because that's not how we see things. We're emotional creatures, you know. We're not thinking about things logically. We're thinking about, I'm hurt in this situation and I feel bad. So if everyone else is doing so well in this moment and I'm not, what have I done wrong? You know, and I feel like that's very much where Scott's coming from, you know, just because this is so new to him, and it just has to hurt a lot. And I think he's just going to that. He's naturally going to that place of, it must be me.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much everything with the episode. And also you probably have to go and actually start working and stuff like that. But I wanted to quickly ask if there was anything that you kind of wanted to say in terms of your experience of, I guess, having your script filmed. Like you mentioned watching the dailies. Did you watch any of the scenes being shot live, or were you busy working on, the other stuff? Or what was the kind of highlight of the episode coming to life for you?
Sadly, I didn't get to see as much of the filming as possible, because by the time we were shooting 508, we were, you know, so close to the end, and we were writing the last couple of episodes at that time. But I was able to get out on set a couple of days to see stuff, and it was great fun because it was my first, you know, my first episode of television to be produced. And also Dave Daniel, our director, he's our DP on every episode, and this was his first episode to direct. So it was wonderful fun going out and sitting there and watching the monitors with him, because he was, you know, we were both kind of like kids in a candy store, just because it was my first script and it was his first episode to direct, and we were both experiencing these things for the first time. And it was just, oh, it was just great fun. And I wish I could have spent every moment of every day out there, but what I did get to see was fun.
Yeah, good times. Karen, was there anything you wanted to ask about creating the episode?
No, I think I got everything answered.
Before Will has to go? Cool. Well, I think that's probably about it. We will let you go to work now. And thank you very much for basically coming in and hanging out with us and talking us through your episode. Is there anything you wanted to talk about or to say before you go about the episode or about anything in general in the world?
I had a great time writing this episode, and I can't tell you the euphoria I felt when my name came on the screen. It was just wonderful, and I'm so proud to be a part of such a great show, and Jeff is an amazing boss, and I love all the writers. Everyone is so great, and everyone on the crew is great, and everyone has been very kind and generous to let me be a part of this show and to give me a shot at writing an episode and just being a part of this. It's the greatest job in the world, and I love it very much. I love it very much. And of course, the Not Another Teen Wolf podcast is the greatest podcast in the world.
Oh,
and I love it very much, and I listen every week, of course, and it's so much fun just being a part of a show that I love, and then getting to hear y'all talk about a show that you love, and that I get to be a part of it and to help shape something that means that's important to you. I mean, that's just the best part, is knowing that I get to work on something that makes other people happy and that makes them feel something, you know, good or bad at times, you know, or wonderful or scared or great. You know, I mean, that's just so much fun, and it's just the greatest job in the world, and I hope I get to be here for as long as possible, and I will, of course, be listening to every single episode y'all do ever, because it's just fun.
Oh, that's so nice. Oh, and embarrassing. But thank you very much for doing that,
most welcome.
Saying that, and yeah, we will, we'll have to, talk more soon, and I suppose, and yeah, you get back to work with 5B and keep things rolling, I suppose. We're all excited for that. I can't believe this arc is almost over. I feel like not that much is going to be resolved in it, basically. So, yeah, I'm a bit worried about that.
No worries. There are good things coming. Lots of good, terrible, awesome drama.
I was like,
and wonderful, wonderful stuff. Great feels. All right.
Yeah, good, like genuinely objective, good things, really, though, really.
Yes, there's good stuff, not good rock, but it's coming. Yes, I can tell you 100%, with 100% confidence, that there's lots of good stuff coming that will make you very happy, and lots of smiles, and just good stuff. So just keep watching. We got good stuff on the way.
I'll be excited to smile again. That would be nice. So, yeah.
Yes.
Cool. We're gonna
All right. Well, y'all have a day.
Yeah, I was gonna say we're gonna wrap it up now. We've got some feedback to go through, but we can probably do that without you, unless there's any questions in particular that you wanted to answer in the feedback. But yeah, if you have to go off to work,
The stuff that I was looking at is gotta keep mum's the word here.
All right, and nothing you can say. Okay, we'll just talk through that. That's fine. You go.
Okay.
And we'll just do that in a moment and put that on the end. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on and thank you for writing and congratulations and yeah, all good and you know, maybe you know next season in 3B we'll do this again if you get another episode as well.
Well, I certainly hope I get another episode and I will always come on the show because y'all are the best.
Cool.
And awesome. Well, yeah, y'all have good days and nights depending on where you are in the world. And yeah, I'll be talking to y'all soon and keep up the good work.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. So we're just going to go through a little bit of feedback after that fun discussion. Did you enjoy that, Karen?
Yeah, that was cool. I always like getting insight into the episode, like not even necessarily the spoilery stuff, because obviously they're tight-lipped about so much and we kind of prefer it that way because we love the show and we don't want to be spoiled, but I like knowing the little things that I don't know about how like production works and, you know, breaking an episode and all of that. I always find that really fascinating.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was good. Good times. And I enjoyed that. But one of the pieces of feedback we got on the Hyperball post was from a commenter called Brack saying, I don't know where this idea comes from that Scott doesn't understand the idea that sometimes lethal force is necessary. I suppose this is, just to interject myself, I suppose this is in response to talking about that Scott, you know, won't kill anyone or that Scott won't forgive Scott Styles for killing or something like that. Said he had a whole conversation with his father about it in Time of Death. He raised no objection when Chris, Brayden and Derek were shooting to kill in Monstrous. He forgave the twins. He still holds out hope that Peter can be redeemed. I don't see how he'd find Styles' situation impossible to understand. How do you feel about that?
I think this is an excellent point, especially like considering everything that the twins have done and, you know, hoping that Peter can be redeemed. I think that's an excellent point to Scott's character. I just wonder if the difference is the fact that it's Styles. You know, Styles is his age, it's his peer, it's his best friend, it's somebody he's known his entire life. I think there's a difference between seeing somebody like Chris, for instance, who is a hunter, who has kind of created this lifestyle for himself to be able to do things like this, or even Derek, who is older and is more worldly and knows sort of the situation, that there's a difference between those people and Styles. I mean, Styles is best friend. He would hope that Styles is better than that, I guess. But, you know, I think in the end, like, Scott is going to forgive Styles. It's not like I think that their friendship is going to be over forever, but I think, like, the shock of it is going to cause a rift between them.
Yeah, I do as well, but, you know, I think maybe this question is regarding, you know, why does Styles think that, you know, Scott would not understand this? But, yeah, I don't know. I don't think that it's going to be unforgivable either, but I think that also, yeah, this idea of Scott, you know, we don't kill people, is something that potentially the show could address in regards to, you know, there's only so long Scott can go around being like, oh, I don't kill people, but I don't mind other people killing people for me or, you know, being around me or defending, you know, my people by killing people. It's just me personally, I won't kill. Like, there's only so long that can kind of fly, maybe. So we'll see. Mm-hmm. I think that it should be interesting. You know, I think that he would maybe not want to think that Styles was the kind of person that could do that, but never mind. Another one, Tumblr, and Anon on Tumblr says, question, how does a werewolf become a real wolf? I thought shape-shifting into a real wolf was like a trial of spirit. Derek went through a lot before he changed into a real wolf, and Talia was one as well. Why can Theo shift into a real wolf when he's a sociopath? Seriously. Like, seriously.
Yeah.
I
that is the question.
Like, I can't. There's something up with him. Why does he have gold eyes when he's killed people? Like, you know, like what? Like, what is happening here? You know, do you think this is more of like, oh, Theo might be a success at a chimera, or oh, Theo has like a pure heart and something is like, you know, possessing him and making him evil?
Oh, I didn't think about that. Like, you know, Nigetsune, Kitsune style. I mean, this is the question, isn't it? I mean, we really don't know.
Why is Theo?
Yeah, why is Theo? I think that it could definitely be because he's a chimera that they've done something with him in order to give him, you know, these powers of, like, so he's not detected, you know, so he has the gold eyes, he has the wolf, I mean, he's hasn't told anybody yet that he can turn into a wolf, but those are things that are going to make people want to trust him, and that's exactly what the Dread Doctors want him to do, is to get close to Scott for whatever end they're both trying to get to. So it makes sense that being a chimera, he would have these specific abilities in order to do that. I really like the idea of, like, actually, you know what? No, I've just changed my mind. I really hate the idea of a spirit possibly inhabiting Theo, because I want Theo to be evil and not to be around anymore. You I just want him, to him go dead. Away. Yeah, that was a really nice way to say, I want Theo to die.
Okay, you want Theo to die. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I but mean, I wouldn't.
He was being possessed by a spirit. I think that negates a lot of what he has done and kind of gives him an excuse, and I don't want him to have an excuse.
Fair enough. I'm quite confused as to, yeah, as to what he, you know, why on earth he might be able to do the things he does, like the gold eyes and the wolf. You know, it could be that, you know, they've made him into the perfect criminal, like this, the, you know, the perfect most. Okay. Have you actually read Twilight?
Yes.
Okay. You know how Edward Cullen explains to Bella that he is made into the perfect predator by becoming this very, like, you know, everything about him is meant to attract you, like his voice and all of that kind of stuff. Like, maybe, like, Theo is, like, the perfect predator or the perfect evildoer because he's been given all of these innocent qualities, if you know what I mean. Like, they've basically give, they've been like, oh, he can't possibly be evil because he hasn't killed anyone. He's got, you know, the eyes. Or, you know, he does the spiritual, pure-hearted wolf thing. You know, like, he's been given these qualities that sort of protect him from being suspicious, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Going on from that, we got a couple of emails from Gavin, who has sent a few things, and I'm just going to read out a couple of points from his emails because they were very long and I enjoyed them very much, and I may reply to them privately, but just a couple of things to share on the podcast. One of the questions he's asked was, if you were visited by the Dread Doctors and were going to be made into a chimera but had a choice which animal or creature or traits, what would you choose?
Dude, that's a really good question.
You don't want creepy wings?
Well, I was like, man, flying would be really cool, but then, like, oh, those wings, like, I'm going to have nightmares about them. Like, my back feels funny right now. I can't think about them anymore. So I will pick my favorite animal on the planet, which is a cheetah. Which would allow me to run really fast. And I feel like that would be super useful in Beacon Hills.
Yeah, that's true, because I suppose, yeah, it would be good with that. I'm trying to think what I would like. Maybe not wings. They seem, like, hard to, like, hide. I would want something that came out when I wanted it to come out. Like, you know, vision, something vision-y would be good. Or breathing underwater. Maybe something fish-like with gills that weren't flapping open in my neck all of the time, that they just activated when I went underwater. That's what I'd like, is swimming power, like vision, like the gillyweed in Harry Potter, but like it didn't affect me the whole time, basically. Yeah, that would be my instant choice, because I really like looking at things underwater, like snorkeling, so that would be good for me.
I want to know what listeners think, too, like if you could choose an animal, you know, tweet us. Let us know.
Or whatever they do, supernatural creature of some sort, like if you'd want to be like part Wendigo or whatever. I don't know why you'd want that. A couple of other ones. Just wondering, did we ever get confirmation who pulled the new growth out of the Nemeton? Because we had the option of Void Styles on Nashiko, but how about our favourite deputy who's taking trips out there? Who knows? I don't know if that is even meant to be a thing or not, but yeah, I'm confused. Okay.
I thought we learned who it was, and for some reason I thought it was Chris. Maybe we were just thinking that it was Chris, and it never got confirmed. It's been a little while since I've been able to watch that. So if anybody does actually remember, please let us know.
True. Yeah, if anyone can answer that question, that would be great. And then he's also added, with Natalie being a big Hannibal fan, has she seen King Arthur and seen who two of the knights are? It was on late one night the other week and I flick over it to it and went, hang on, that's Will Graham and Dr. Lecter. Yes, you have no idea how aware I am. I saw that movie like in the cinemas and I was like taken. They have really good chemistry in that movie. They play Tristan and Galahad, I think, like two of the knights of the Round Table, and they have like sassy chemistry, even them, and it's one, I think it's one of the reasons why they got cast in Hannibal, because they got on really well and they had previous chemistry. So yes, I am super aware of that. But just scrolling through quickly to a couple of other points, which is one of them saying, do you think Styles's willingness to kill could bode well for him becoming an emissary? We know they're about balance and Morel was willing to help him but also to kill him. So what do you think about, like, the whole emissary role and what they do with balance and whether that's something that Styles would be right for?
I think that in a lot of ways we've been sort of seeing that idea move along slowly throughout the series just because of everything with the Mountain Ash and, you know, Be the Spark and all of that sort of thing. I didn't think about the whole balance part of it, but I think that's really interesting. I would love to see Styles become an emissary because I think that would allow him a little more like power and maybe physicality. Like he could learn to defend himself more, like what Lydia is trying to go through right now and all of that. I don't know if that's something that will actually happen, but I would love to learn more about the emissaries, and I would love for Scott to have an emissary. I don't know if Deaton is technically his emissary, but he should probably get a replacement.
Yeah, I don't know if he's very good at it. He might want someone of his own generation. I think that the balance thing is a good point, but I don't know if that's where Styles is at about it at the moment. I don't know. I think there's a lot of those pieces that could fit together, but I need to know more about Styles killing people, basically, to make that call properly. Couple of other things. Another email we had from Rachel said, the thing I love, she was talking about how everything on Teen Wolf has happened on Buffy. So saying, the thing I love most is how it's a new Buffy. Buffy will always be better, though. I mean, it's different. This season is akin to Buffy season 4, the initiative building a crazy monster, a chimera, out of parts of demons. The episode The Yoko Factor, turning the gang against each other. The last episode, Restless, that ends the season with the gang being stalked and killed in their dreams. If you know the Buffyverse in and out like I do, you can see where Teen Wolf is going and what will happen. Oh my god, will Scott get a little brother that never existed before this season? Because that was the culmination of season 4 of Buffy. But anyway, what do you think that they're referring to besides Dawn?
Oh gosh, I'm not really sure. I mean, there are definitely lots of parallels between Buffy and Teen Wolf. I think that sort of just happens when Buffy was such a huge influence in this genre of shows that it makes sense to want to pay homage to that. And as to where they're going, I don't know. I mean, I still think that Teen Wolf is different, and I don't think that they're going to do anything that's ever too close to what Buffy did. I think that they're still their own entity and that it's going to be something different. But I honestly, truthfully, have no idea what's going to happen in these last two episodes. I can't even begin to guess. The only thing I know is that it's probably going to be bad.
Oh, well, yeah, that's true. I'm not quite sure what plot point of Buffy they're referring to here either. I'm trying to remember what happens. I mean, the initiative gets overthrown, obviously, eventually, but, well, sort of. But I don't know, I'm curious. Write in and tell us what you mean, because I'm trying to think through it, and I may go and read up season 4 of Buffy again to see what you have found, basically. So I am excited to figure that out. But I don't know if it's exactly the same as Buffy, you know. I don't know if we can make that prediction. And, you know, I'd also think that, you know, if they want to do something different, even if they know there is a parallel, they'd purposely do something different. Like, not that the path would end up being exactly the same. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that, you know, I see the similarities, but I don't know if we can expect that to give us the answers. All right, we will let you guys all get back to your lives now and hope you've enjoyed our Teen Wolf rambling with Will Wallace and with our nice fan theories. If you want to write to us, you can, and we'll put you on the podcast next week. Tumblr, Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast on Tumblr, or Twitter, NATW Podcast, or Gmail, natwpodcast@gmail.com. I read out a few tweets during the course of the episode as well, including one by something Kayla, Katya, underscore Katya Flores, underscore, was the person who gave me the idea, saying, maybe a stretch, but didn't Dr. D say they were working on babies? Maybe Malia was experimented on before birth, which could be a reason why, you know, if the Desert Wolf, for all of her, you know, craziness and aggression, does fight on the side for quote-unquote good, she could be trying to eliminate all of the chimeras, including her own daughter. So, you never know. That seems to be that theory, but I'm not sure if that's what her story is going to be or not, obviously. Yeah, I guess we'll see you next week. What's the episode next week called?
It is called Lies of Omission.
Okay, interesting. And when do you think that we're going to get all of these reveals about Theo and about all of the crazy nonsense, basically?
Possibly this next episode, since it's called Lies of Omission. Also, I just saw the title for the 10th episode. Is this real? Because it's called Status Asthmaticus.
Yeah, it's real. Actually, I actually saw a great ask on Tumblr about that, but I thought that we'd already covered status asthmatic, like that news. So I'll just pull it up actually right now, because it's actually quite important if you didn't know that already. So hang on. I'll just grab it because I had it one moment ago. Yeah, the finale is called Status Asthmaticus. And we had Blue Florette, who actually had a comment last week, who was great, but saying, I was hunting around to see if there were any new information for next week's episode on Zatwip when I noticed that we have an episode title for the 5A finale, Status Asthmaticus. Given Scott's 2 asthma attacks in required reading, despite his werewolf powers, and obviously I'll add in that he, you know, had to use his inhaler again this week for whatever reason, a season finale named after a severe asthma attack that doesn't respond to normal treatment sounds kind of terrifying, and that would be true even if viewers weren't already told to expect a cliffhanger leading into 5B. Teen Wolf likes their multi-layer episode titles, so I thought it was interesting to see this medical condition also described as attacks that follow one another without pause. Sounds a little like all the problems the pack have been facing since senior year began, or even all of the seasons viewed as a whole. Blue Florette, you should come and do the podcast instead of me, because you're clearly you clearly come up with better ideas than I do. So yeah. So is this a real thing, Status Asthmaticus?
Okay, that's cool. I mean, it's much less funny now, but I was like, wait, what? Is it really called that? It seemed a little, like, silly, but if it's real, then...
It's real. Yeah,
okay.
It's real. Acute severe asthma, also referred to as Status Asthmaticus. Some medical technician had fun naming that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's kind of funny, but also when you learn what it is, quite terrifying. So, I mean, it makes sense as the mid-season finale for season 5, so guess I'm not too surprised.
Yeah, good times. All right, well, I suppose with all of that, we'll go, and we'll talk to you guys next week after Lies of Omission. So, yeah. All right, until then, it's been real, guys, I guess. You okay?
Yeah, just what kind of sign-off was that?
It's been real.
Yes, it's been so real.
Keep it cool. I don't know, something. I'm going to go. All right. It's 2:30 a.m., so all right, I'm going to go.
Yes.
Okay.
Bye. Bye, everyone.
Bye. That came out really, really high. Sorry. I don't know why. All right.